Well, it looks like we're getting some snow again, finally, and it's about heckin' time. I'll tell you what, feller.
Are you getting it this weekend or after? Because I mean, we're getting ours this weekend. I assumed it was coming from the east, so maybe it's coming from you guys.
It's not down here in the valley where we're at, but it has been progressively snowing pretty much every day, a couple inches up in the mountains. And
oh, really?
The guy is stoked. I am. There's been a deficit of snow, and it needs to be here, and I need to go enjoy it.
I was going to say, you're going to hit the slopes again?
I'm going to try.
One, two more times?
I want to do at minimum one. But okay. Just money and time and snow. But I think we might have a chance.
Well, if you have the money and time and no snow, do you really have anything?
No, because the other two are never here either.
That's the spirit.
Yeah, but, I mean, some people... we've had a couple of fall springs at this point, and some people are ready for summer and spring, my wife being one of them. But I tell you what, I am not done with the snow, and we need some more snow so we can have hopefully less of a crazy wildfire season, you know? So that's we need fair. It. Let it snow. Let it rain, dear.
I wouldn't mind rain. I'm kind of over the snow. I'm at the point where it's like, yeah, I could go for warmer weather, like Nicole. And I think we're supposed to get some snow rain mix tomorrow night through the weekend.
Mm.
Probably not much down here, more than rain, or at least nothing sticking, but
yeah.
I suppose we do need it. I should be appreciative of it.
We've definitely gotten to the age of like, you know, it starts raining, you look up at the sky. Yeah, we needed this. That's the age we're in right
when
now.
When you realize when you need that, and then it's just like, oh man, this is a cool laundry basket. It's like, I never thought I'd actually say that about a laundry basket.
Yeah,
I was excited to have my house vacuumed earlier.
I know. it's quite lovely. Well, let us know what your guys' favorite weather is. Are you guys done with the snow, the rain, all the seasonal depression and such? Let us know. Underthewayspodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to know, how is the weather where you are?
Yeah. And speaking of spring coming around the corner, we posted on our socials today. I think that the locks, the Sioux locks. Hang on, I should have paid more attention.
I saw it. I saw the story.
Was it the Sioux locks? Okay, good.
It was opening. On the post, it was like S O O, even though it's
yeah. That's how they apparently shorthand it.
Well, I mean,
I say they as if I didn't know.
That's how it should be spelled anyway.
Yeah, instead of S, isn't it? No, it's S A U L T. Yeah. But yeah, Sioux Locks opening day is March 25th.
So it's happening. It's
exciting
happening.
Exciting times for them as well.
Yeah. Well, hello!
Ahoy!
And welcome to the Under the Waves podcast. It's a podcast and a show about all things shipwrecks on and under the Great Lakes. My name's Andrew.
What a whiplash. And I'm Michelle, your captain for this week. Welcome Ahoy. Aboard. Was my line.
Well, you said it so I could steal it.
Thanks. So tonight we are coming to you live, well, almost live, definitely alive, about a ship that at the time of this recording, which is March 12th, 2025, right? Yeah, okay. Was just reported by the Great Lakes Shipwreck Historical Society 2 days ago to have been found after 132 years. Like, this is fresh.
Breaking news, hot off
fresh
the press.
Stuff.
It's pretty exciting.
Exactly. The find was officially announced at the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeological Association's annual Ghost Ships meeting in Manitowoc a few days ago, and then made public on Monday. Also, I want to attend the next Ghost Ship meeting. Is it like invite only? Is it like, can you just show up? Do you buy tickets? We need answers to these things. A Ghost Ship meeting? Absolutely.
That is a good question.
The article about the shipwreck find was sent to us by a few of our listeners, which thank you guys for staying on top of things. And by the time this comes out, it will have been a few weeks old, but it's so new, it's like history in the making. In fact, Bruce Lynn, executive director of the Great Lakes Shipwreck Historical Society, we brought him up in last week's episode about the Adela Shores. He told Journal Sentinel that the ship is, quote, the most important shipwreck the Historic Society has ever found, end quote, and that it's one of 13 shipwrecks the Society has found in the past 3 years and has already drawn the most attention out of all of them.
I mean, that's no small feat. Those are some big words.
That's quite the lead up and introduction.
Yes.
We are talking about the ship, the SS Western Reserve. Sorry for two back-to-back Lake Superior episodes in a row, but we just couldn't not cover it, and it ties in so well with last week's episode that we really didn't have a choice in the matter. Our hands were tied. We started with one, but we'll bring back more characters we introduced you to in the last episode. Don't worry, there'll be a pop quiz at the end. There's a picture we'll post of the Western Reserve. There's a couple pictures, and one of them was titled Prior to Sinking, which is like, thank you. I can tell it's on top of the water.
Yeah, but there's a lot of water under it, not above it. Here's your clue.
Spoiler alert, in case you didn't get the rest of it until now, it sank. So, let's get into it. The Western Reserve was a 300-foot, 91-meter long steel steamer with a beam of approximately 41 feet, 13 meters, and a depth of 21 feet, or 6 meters. She was built by the Cleveland Shipbuilding Company in Cleveland, Ohio, and cost $200,000 in the day, which guess what it is today, Andrew?
I'm going to guess that's $1.2 million.
Oh, interesting.
No, 1.1. We'll do 1.1. Sorry.
Well, you're a little off. It's $6.9 million today.
Well, you know, you can't win them all.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, can't win them all.
No, well, good try. Thanks for participating.
Thanks for playing.
And her name, Western Reserve, came from the Connecticut Western Reserve, which was a 3.3 million acre portion of land granted to the would-be American colonies by King Charles II. Connecticut, I lost my place. Connecticut relinquished its claim to some of the land to the United States in 1786 after the American Revolutionary War and prior to the establishment of the Northwest Territory. Connecticut retained ownership of the eastern portion of it south of Lake Erie, but sold much of the Western Reserve to a group of speculators who operated the Connecticut Land Company. This company divvied up the land into sections and sold it to new settlers moving west for development and settlement. The Western Reserve is now a northern section of the state of Ohio. And also, it's so weird to think of Ohio as being the West.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at that time, yeah, everyone was in New England area, but it's like, oh, the great old West, Ohio.
Ohio.
Oh, man, wild times.
Yeah.
The Western Reserve, the ship, was one of the first all-steel vessels on the Great Lakes at the time of her build and considered an, quote, engineering marvel and a gleaming symbol of American industrial might, end quote. The other ship to be constructed out of steel plate, the SS W.H. Gilcher, was a similar build and dimensions to the Western Reserve. The steel construction was to help make the ships capable of carrying heavier loads of freight than their wooden counterparts. Apparently, the Western Reserve set the record for her time of carrying the largest coal cargo into Milwaukee, but since she tragically sank soon after her Great Lake debut, her life's endeavors are often overshadowed and left more to the imagination. She looks like a bathtub toy boat. It's just she's like very high all around.
Yeah,
it makes no sense. Yeah, you'll see when you see the pictures, but it looks
just a
like
a big boat with a very small like cabin area or like conning, you know, what a cockpit area, whatever you want to call it.
Not a submarine. Well, I mean, house. She tried.
Yeah, like a yeah, very pilot house. Small, short pilot house on top of this big boat.
Yeah, and it, I don't know, it just kind of looks like something you see in a it's bathtub, goofy. Except 300 feet long.
Yeah.
As the Daily Mail said, the Western Reserve was, quote, more than just a ship. She was a floating palace of steel and steam, a testimony to the boundless optimism of the age, end quote. The Western Reserve was built to break cargo shipping records, along with being deemed one of the safest ships afloat. Almost like calling her unsinkable, but that never led to anything bad with a ship, right?
Can't think right. of a thing.
Mm-mm, absolutely not. One newspaper at the time called the Western Reserve, quote, the inland greyhound, end quote, due to her impressive speed with which she traversed the lakes. This power was all in part due to her, would you like to say it, Andrew?
Triple expansion steam engine. It was a 3-cylinder triple expansion steam engine.
Thanks. I wanted to save my throat.
That's phenomenal. That's exciting. Way to go. Triple expansion steam engine. Equipped.
Exactly.
Check mark.
What else do you need? A steam-powered boat, a steel-plated ship, and a 3-cylinder triple expansion steam engine. This allowed her to travel at a speed of 12 knots, which is 14 miles per hour, or 22 kilometers per hour, which I know doesn't seem fast, but ships were only starting to use the triple expansion steam engines on the Great Lakes in the late 1880s, so it was still a relatively new phenomenon. From all accounts our researcher could find, a majority of the wooden steamships traveled anywhere from 6 to 9 knots, which is 7 to 10 miles per hour, or 11 to 16 kilometers per hour. So this was just under double the speed at the time of her launch.
Blistering speed.
Can you imagine fast being 14 miles an hour?
I mean, I can't walk that fast. Or run that fast.
I can't swim that fast either, so I guess they're onto something.
I guess it makes sense with it being water. Swimming's a good correlation. That's fine.
Walking's fine, too. You can walk on water, right?
New.
The Western Reserve was launched on August 20th, 1890, took her maiden voyage on October 6th of the same year, and was owned by millionaire at the time, Captain Peter G. Minch, and was a flagship of the Minch Transportation Company. He was highly respected and held great influence and standing within the shipping community. Minch was also referred to as a shipping magnate and lived... Magnate? I think it's magnate. Not magnate. Sure, magnate. Like a fridge magnate.
It wasn't drawn to him. He was just a magnate. Or something like that.
That would have made more sense because she's a steel ship. That's a pity laugh, thanks. Minch was also referred to as a shipping magnate and lived in Cleveland, Ohio. Not much could be found about her short 2-year life, but usually that means no accidents, or if so, those of little consequence to the integrity of the ship. Her smooth sailing would be abruptly cut short on August 30th, stop saying 1900. Her smooth sailing would be abruptly cut short on August 30th, 1892. Articles mention that the Western Reserve was, quote, traveling in ballast, end quote. Gathering from anything we could find alluding to this phrase online, as well as the knowledge that the Western Reserve was traveling empty and upbound towards two harbors, a port in Minnesota just northwest of Duluth, we believe that traveling in ballast means that she was utilizing her ballast tanks to make the ship more steady without having a load on it. Due to no cargo, the Western Reserve was sitting high in the water, which might not have helped the situation. She was headed to two harbors to pick up a load of iron ore from the Minnesota Iron Ranges and was being mastered by Captain Albert Meyer. Let it be noted that both Meyer and Minch were considered well-seasoned mariners. Deciding to take his family on a pleasant end-of-summer cruise through Lake Huron en route to Minnesota, Captain Minch decided to take a ride on the Western Reserve and bring along with him his family. This included his wife, Anna, two young children, Charlie, 9, and Florence, 6, his sister-in-law, Anna's sister, Mary Engelbry, and her daughter, Bertha, 10. The trip was going smoothly and the weather was pleasant as they steamed up Lake St. Clair, then Lake Huron, and through the Sioux Locks. That is, until they reached the dreaded Whitefish Bay.
Man, two for two, Whitefish Bay, like two episodes in a row, just...
Yeah.
It's a scary spot. It's
called the graveyard of Lake Superior for a reason.
Yeah, it all checks out.
Shortly after they passed the Iroquois Lighthouse in Whitefish Bay, the weather shifted and the winds picked up intensity. The crew decided it best to drop anchor near the Whitefish Point Lighthouse and waited for better, smoother conditions. Remember, this was in late August. Yes, storms can pop up suddenly on the Great Lakes regardless of the time of year, but it wasn't the end of the shipping season when things were rough, no pun intended. It wasn't during the infamous November gales. This was still summer. Yes, the water is freezing no matter what month it is, but summers in the Midwest are usually lovely. Unfortunately for the Western Reserve and those on board, the weather did not let up. They waited around for an indeterminate time to see if the storm would let up, but it only seemed to grow worse. Perhaps seeing that waiting around like a sitting duck wasn't doing them any good, the anchor was pulled up and the Western Reserve headed out into Lake Superior. The storm grew worse and overtook them around 9 p.m. on August 30th, 1892. The Western Reserve started to break up and began to sink. The Minch family, along with the crew, all safely boarded and launched the ship's two lifeboats, one metal and one made out of wood. In the process, wheelsman Harry W. Stewart had to jump over a 3-foot crack in the freighter's deck to reach the aft where the lifeboats were stored. He comes up later, hence naming him. Almost immediately, the metal lifeboat containing most of the crew overturned and all but two on board disappeared in the swells. The two, one of them being Stewart, were spotted and pulled into the second wooden lifeboat, which contained the Minch family along with the remaining crew. They watched as within 10 minutes the Western Reserve had also disappeared. And that would be such an eerie feeling. Like, just, you yeah, think middle this,
of the lake.
It's like, called the ship, the shippest. It was the shippest ship of the ships that ever shipped. It was the safest ship at that time, and it's just, it's gone.
Yeah, it just breaks apart and just sinks within 10 minutes. That's,
oh, that's so not scary.
Something you want to muck about with. That's no. Terrifying.
Yeah. The second lifeboat would end up battling the storm and darkness for the next 10 hours. Once, the overloaded boat swamped with water, and those on board used hats to try and bail out the water. The survivors were suddenly filled with hope when a steamship, Nishoto, passed by them during the night. Everyone on board screamed and yelled for about a half an hour, but amongst the tempest all around them, they were not heard. The lifeboat unfortunately didn't have flares on board, so they were unable to make themselves seen to the passing ships. And yeah, I did check if flares were around at that time, and apparently they've been around for couple decades by then. At around 7:30 a.m. the next morning, the lifeboat was within 1 mile of the shoreline, just west of the Deer Park Life Saving Station. This is on Lake Superior's southeastern shoreline. The bedraggled group had drifted upbound and around Whitefish Point, which was west of Whitefish Bay. Again, within only 1 mile, or 1.6 kilometers, of the life saving station, the remaining lifeboat overturned in the breakers, losing all but one man. The only survivor out of the 28 on board the Western Reserve was the wheelsman Harry W. Stewart of Algonac, Michigan. He managed to swim the remaining mile to shore and landed on a desolate stretch of Upper Peninsula between Grand Marais and Deer Park. When he was rescued, he described the Western Reserve encountering metal and structural fatigue. This, combined with the ship's young age, almost conclusively evidenced that the shipbuilders who built her hadn't properly used the steel that becomes brittle in cold temperatures, including water temps. A few sources said that the steel was contaminated with sulfur and phosphorus, which contributed to its weakness and inability to stand up to the cold. To be fair, it was the beginning of the era of building ships from steel, and a lot was probably unknown. And to add insult to injury, the Western Reserve's counterpart, the W.H. Gilcher that we mentioned earlier, would end up disappearing on Northern Lake Michigan only 8 weeks later. She was also built at the same time and with similar mill runs of steel plate. These two closely related wrecks, along with the tragic losses of life, fortunately led to permanent changes being made for the types of steel approved for use in both U.S. and Canadian shipbuilding. In an eerie twist of fate, such changes in steel manufacturing for ships was not made to the British law at the same time. British shipbuilding continued to allow the use of brittle steel in shipbuilding after 1892, which would eventually include the White Star Line's transatlantic liner RMS Titanic to be made of very similar materials as the Western Reserve and the W.H. Gilcher.
Ain't no way.
I reacted the same way when I read it.
My goodness, that's so isn't tragic. That
horrible.
It's horrible. It's full of horror.
Like, that they is made the changes.
Wild.
I think it's, let's see, Titanic was what, 1914? That's just over 20 years later. Did I math that right? Yeah.
Probably. That's like, nuts.
So you have ships that have had instances of being in contact with cold water and falling apart, sinking, breaking, whatever, due to that. And so there are things that are passed in the U.S. and Canada, like, we're not making ships out of this anymore. We have to change it up. And Great Britain's like, meh, they were fine. We got the salt to help us. I don't know. And whatever they were thinking. Or they just didn't care.
Yeah. But and, like, this is not the only factor.
It's not.
Is it guaranteed if it was made out of this, you know, other type of steel, this less brittle type of steel, is it guaranteed it would not have sunk? Absolutely not. But it would have helped. It would have helped.
It had the potential because she had other ships around her that could have gotten to her in time, but she sank so quickly. The Titanic.
Yeah.
I mean, so did the Western Reserve, but yeah. Oh man. Yeah. I was
folks,
just,
you can't see our faces at home, but like I was hand to forehead. Like,
I was
just in awe. Just, are you? I'm seeing where this is going. Can you believe me? Help me understand.
I was trying to stay serious and read it, but I could see Andy's reaction in the corner of my eye. I was like, I feel the same way. Let me get this out. But, oh man, it's crazy.
Let me say it. Big if true.
I mean, Speaking of, samples taken from the Titanic's hull plates and rivets after her discovery showed that the material of the iron and steel used to build her more than likely played a significant role in speeding up her sinking due to structural failure, much like the Western Reserve. Meanwhile, steel lake freighters in both the U.S. and Canada in the first half of the 1900s were made using improved standards for steel production and could plow through ice floes, suffering some damage but not sinking. So whether it sank the Titanic or not, it definitely would have slowed down that process and potentially allowed for more lives to be saved.
Help me, Rhonda. I can't. I'm just agape and aghast.
Yep. And I read that, I was like, oh my gosh, the conspiracies. As it was with last week's episode, the Western Reserve was found by the Great Lakes Shipwreck Historical Society about 60 miles or 97 kilometers northwest of Whitefish Point in Lake Superior. Using marine sonic technology, side scan sonar on board their research vessel, named David Boyd, the society made the initial discovery of the ship on July 22, 2024. Recall that the GLSHS waited around 3 years with the Adela Shores from finding her to announcing the discovery. This turnaround was way quicker. 8 days after initially spotting the wreck via the side scan sonar, or SSS, a remotely operated vehicle, or ROV, was sent down to try and confirm the identity. What they saw was fascinating. They saw a ship apparently broken into two pieces with the bow section resting on top of the stern. The vessel was at a depth of about 600 feet or 183 meters of water. Daryl Ertl, director of marine operations and who found the Shores we discussed about last week, alongside with his brother Dan, who was also first mate, said, quote, "Knowing how the 300-foot Western Reserve was caught in a storm this far from shore made an uneasy feeling in the back of my neck. A squall can come up unexpectedly anywhere and anytime," end quote. Daryl and Dan Ertl had been looking for the Western Reserve for over 2 years when they finally found her. It was almost luck that, according to an NBC News article who also interviewed Bruce Lynn, quote, "heavy ship traffic that day forced them to alter their course, though, and search an area adjacent to their original search grid," end quote. Corey Atkins, Great Lakes Shipwreck Historical Society's communications director, said that, quote, "the crew exchanged high fives in colorful language at the discovery of the Western Reserve." And we got another side scan sonar picture, and you can see it almost looks like building blocks. It's definitely broken in the middle.
Oh, it's definitely broken up, and like it's weird because yeah, it is kind of sitting on top of itself. It's just wild.
Daryl also told reporters, quote, "we side scan looking at a half mile per side, and we caught an image on our port side. It was very small looking out that far, but I measured the shadow and it came up about 40 feet. So we went back over the top of the ship and saw that it had cargo hatches, and it looked like it was broken in two, one half on top of the other, and each half measured with a side scan 150 feet long, and then we measured the width and it was right on, so we knew we had found the Western Reserve." Bruce Lynn said in another interview, quote, "every shipwreck has its own story, but some are just that much more tragic. It is hard to imagine that Captain Peter G. Minch would have foreseen any trouble when he invited his wife, two young children, and sister-in-law with her daughter aboard the Western Reserve for a summer cruise up the lakes. It just reinforces how dangerous the Great Lakes can be any time of year," end quote. There are photos of the Western Reserve that we'll post. Photo credit goes to the Great Lakes Shipwreck Historical Society, and you can find videos out there of the sites collected from the wreck. Apparently, they haven't been able to get a whole lot of footage due to the weather not behaving in order for them to do so safely. If there's an update with photos in the near future as they plan to go back, we'll be sure to post them to our socials to keep you guys up to date. What is cool about the wreck, though, is that due to the lack of invasive zebra and quagga mussels to Lake Superior, like we've covered in previous bonus questions, the Western Reserve is very much visible, including the ship's paint. I'm personally hoping for a picture of her name, assuming it's still there, in the near future. Her ship's bell is also intact, though on its side. Bruce Lynn says that the wreck is pretty torn up despite the ship being so well preserved as a whole. As of now, the only item that has been recovered from the Western Reserve is the starboard running light, which is currently in the National Museum of Great Lakes in Toledo, Ohio. Anyone want to go for a field trip? Or if anyone close by who lives there can go and send us a picture, definitely send us an email. Apparently, the freighter was identified by having her port side running light that had a red lens. This lens washed ashore in Canada shortly after the ship sank, and the recovered starboard light and the port light are a match. And I think they're both at the museum together. And that is the cool, fresh off the press story of the Western Reserve that was recently found within a couple months ago and is now, it was now news as of 2 days ago.
Hooray!
And yeah, the pictures are pretty cool, but yeah, I hope they can go back and
snag some more.
Yeah. But it's eerie. There's a broken mast. I think that has a bell on it. The bell's on its side, which is not usually normal for a shipwreck. It's usually still upright.
Yeah, but yeah, since it's attached to what looks like a mast and that's snapped off. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Pretty cool. R.I.P. to all those who went down with her, but absolutely. Also, I'm so glad. I'm sure it's a lot of, hopefully, closure for those whose family was on board.
Yeah, yeah, it's cool that they actually were able to find it, and yeah, we can have some sort of ending to that story.
Yeah.
Well, last week's trivia, is the Statue of Liberty considered a lighthouse, and was this the statue's original intended duty? The answer? Although not originally intended to be such, the Statue of Liberty did indeed function as a lighthouse for 16 years. Unfortunately for her, she was not a very good lighthouse, as she did not emit enough light to warn and guide ships into the New York Harbor. She ended up being described in a local newspaper, The World, as, quote, more like a glowworm than a beacon, end quote.
That's such an insult. Yeah. Oh, it's a little glowworm of a lighthouse.
Yeah, that's definitely not doing the job.
Mm-mm.
Well, as we mentioned, Lady Liberty wasn't intended to be a lighthouse, but when the idea was brought up to her designer, Frederick Bartoli, he was excited to somehow make the statue holding a torch now have a working light-up torch. Even more, and that's a torch like, you know, what Americans think of as, you know, everyone probably knows what the Statue of Liberty is.
I'm like a burning end of a stick, not like a light, not a
flashlight.
Thank you. Like a light stick. Like
the burning end of a stick.
Well said. Two for two, anti-Britain. Just kidding. I'm gonna cut that. That's weird.
Have a spot of tea while you're at it, eh? Even more exciting, the statue would be illuminated using the newfangled electric light bulb. This would make the Statue of Liberty the first lighthouse in the United States to actually be lit by electricity while all of the rest were still running off of kerosene lamps. Bartoli?
Two facts I didn't know. Oh, yeah, Bartoli.
So really, they were lighting up the lighthouse, which had a glowworm of a light.
Mm-hmm.
So probably the lighthouse itself, quote-unquote, was brighter than the light, which is kind of weird to think about.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bartoli and his engineers, one of which was Gustave Eiffel, the same one who created the Eiffel Tower, worked to figure out the logistics of lighting up the statue. Initially, they thought about installing a sort of floodlight along the ledges of the upheld torch, but the idea had the potential of working too well, potentially blinding sailors instead of helping them and causing shipwrecks in lieu of preventing them. So instead, windows were cut into the torch with the electric lights placed inside, illuminating the torch from within. While the production...
Cool to see.
It would be. While the production of installing the lights and the steam electricity plant and dynamo generator needed for running said lights was free to the United States government, the cost of keeping the lights on was costing the U.S. a pretty penny, and they weren't thrilled. The initial setup was at no cost due to the power plant itself, and the first week of the statue's illumination was donated by the American Electric Light Manufacturing Company. Lady Liberty was originally illuminated on November 1, 1886, and stayed lit for that donated week. But once that week was over, she went dark again.
Which, you could have been fired as a light keeper if your light went out. And the government's just like, meh, I don't want to pay this.
Fire them.
It doesn't matter, apparently.
Oh, man. The president at the time, Grover Cleveland, quickly made the Statue of Liberty the Lighthouse Board's problem. The Lighthouse Board was also not too happy about this assignment, as according to thehistorynerd.com, quote, the statue was expensive, difficult to light, and did no actual good as a navigational aid. End quote. A huge problem regarding the illumination part was that there were no amplifying lenses in the torch, as is present in most every, if not every, other lighthouse. This made the electric light weak. While a good lighthouse can be seen 30 to 40 miles away, 48 to 64 kilometers, and some claim that Liberty's light could be seen 24 miles or 39 kilometers out to sea, in reality, the light didn't even reach the 8 miles to Manhattan.
So that's
a little bit depressing.
How many times is 8 going to 30? 4 times? Almost 5 times less than what a normal lighthouse minimally does?
Yeah. No, it's like 4, just under 4 times.
Okay, yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
I jumped too high.
It's okay. Your math was mathing earlier, and I'm happy to step in now.
Thank you.
The first and subsequently only lighthouse keeper was Albert E. Littlefield. He was hired in December of 1886 and chosen due to his expertise with electricity. He kept the Statue of Liberty lit for 16 years. During this time, he also made improvements that made the lighthouse less expensive. Despite all of his efforts, the Statue of Liberty was a significant drain on the lighthouse board resources for the lack of return, and on March 1st, 1902, her light was officially shut off.
Kind of sad. I didn't know it used to be a lighthouse. Didn't know it failed as a lighthouse. Didn't know everyone basically hated running it. And didn't know it lasted for 16 years. So I thought it was a cool fun fact. Yeah, it was a little long. But you did a great job reading it. And I, every turn, I was like, I'm learning more and more stuff.
Yeah, it was this was cool. A very informative session.
That's kind of cool. So thank you. This week's trivia, psych, it's our week off. Enjoy the extra 2 minutes or so of your time that we're giving back to you. You're welcome. We hope you find your way back here next week. For more Great Lake and Shipwreck stories, give us a follow on the socials, where you can also find the photos that go along with each episode. It's almost like having an audio storybook. I think we said that last time too. Keep it consistent. Instagram is at Under the Waves Podcast and Facebook is Under the Waves Podcast. Send us an email if you just want to receive back an email that isn't spam for once at underthewavespodcast@gmail.com. And remember that all of our sources are listed on our show notes page on our website, www.underthewavespodcast.com. And if you don't get the trend by now, are you even listening? There's also a link to it. Go back to muted. There's also a link to it in our episode description for each episode, regardless of your listening platform. If you're listening and you ate a banana with your breakfast, drop us a like and or a follow.
Dang it! I had one for lunch.
Aw, rough timing. I was going to have one and then I forgot, so we're both failing.
Feel free to share this episode with your barista next time you're getting what Michelle likes to call her go-go be nice to people juice. Perhaps you like to order from the chaos that is Dutch Bros. I sometimes like that. Maybe you prefer the edgier and more intimidating settings of a local coffee shop. You know, the one with all the plants and weird names for the drinks. Or perhaps you were introduced to Starbucks early in your life and remained your tried and true ever since. Plus, you already know all the lingo. Maybe you like to make your brew at home because you're just that talented and need to put the Nespresso machine to use to justify it taking up space on your already overcrowded counter. Whatever the case may be, share this with your supplier of life-giving bean juice. Who knows, they may like it well enough to give you an extra shot of espresso or a dollop of whipped cream as a thank you. And if coffee isn't your jam, share this with your tea dealer, your Frappuccino wielder, and your hot cocoa handler, or whatever your morning pick-me-up beverage of choice might be. Be a hero, pass this on, and go forth energized for the day. We release new episodes every Friday. And until then, fair winds and following seas.
We'll catch you next time under the waves. Bye!
Cheers!